This episode is sponsored by Podmatch. Imagine your favorite online dating app, but instead of using it for finding dates, you are booking podcast interviews. Podmatch is a software platform that automatically matches ideal podcast guests and hosts together to record high-quality podcast interviews. It doesn't matter if you want to host your own show or you would like to join someone else's show. Podmatch will find the ideal match for you to be a part of. You can message and book your matches without ever exchanging an email and use their built-in calendar integration so you can quickly finalize bookings without having to be involved. Podmatch has generated 45,636 interviews among their 14,241 members. Podmatch has also been featured by Business Insider, Yahoo Finance, and Forbes. So what are you waiting for? You can go to www.joinpodmatch.com/ragacy. I repeat again, www.joinpodmatch.com/ragacy. So we'll see you there and happy matching. As we all know, financial advisors are often portrayed as experts who can guide you through the complex world of finance, helping you achieve your financial goals. However, there's a growing concern about the quality of advice some financial advisors provide. While many are reputable professionals genuinely dedicated to help their clients, there's a subset that falls short of expectations, leaving individuals in worse financial situations. And, you know, managing your finances and achieving financial freedom might be a daunting task, but fret not, because this cash flow expert and I have your back. Well, hi, my name is Rayson and I'm your host for The Ragacy Show. And tonight in this episode, we've invited an incredible entrepreneur. His name is none other than Chris Miles. Chris is an anti-financial advisor and he is a leading authority teaching entrepreneurs and professionals how to get their money working for them today. He's an author and podcast host of the Money Ripples podcast, and he has been featured in numerous publications such as US News, CNN, Money, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and Bigger Pockets. And you know what? He also has a proven reputation with his company, Money Ripples, getting his clients fast financial results. And in fact, his personal clients have increased their cash flow by $300+ million in the last 13 years. Well, without further ado, let's welcome Chris into the podcast. Woohoo!
Hey, thanks for having me on today.
Hey, you're most welcome, man. Wow, it's really a huge honor for me to be having you on the podcast. And how have you been, man?
I've been well, you know. I'm a little sore after running a marathon a few days ago, but, you know, I can still move slowly at this point.
Okay. Oh, which marathon did you go? Did you
This one was a marathon in Utah. It actually dropped almost 5,000 feet in elevation over those 26 miles. So it was a big downhill race that, you know, definitely beats up on your legs a little bit and your feet and things like that. So it wasn't my prettiest race. It was probably one of the worst races I did in the last 10 years, but I still won first place for my age group, so I'll take it.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Congratulations, man. Oh, that's nice. Well, you know, like winning the race for your age group is not easy as well. And you have so many other competitors that are probably around your age, around your size, and maybe some even that are fitter than you and, you know, they're competing with you running downhill. Wow, that's crazy. Do you have video footage of that or something like that?
Not video, but I do have some photos. I even posted on Facebook just a few days ago showing you.
Oh, you know, okay.
Including one photo where I looked really strong, but then the next mile I already knew I didn't look that good.
Wow, I can imagine that. Well, if it's me, I'll definitely drop dead in the next, probably in the probably 2 miles, 3 miles, I'll be gone. But anyway, welcome to the podcast. And I just want to check with you. Can you share with the audience a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Yeah. So you mentioned I'm like the anti-financial advisor and cash flow expert, right? Yes. And you said it best in the beginning, like many people don't realize financial advisors are not financial experts. They're really just financial salespeople in suits. That's really what they're trained to do. And I know because I was one. Now, I didn't start out that way. You know, when I was growing up with my family, you know, my parents taught me good values about working hard. Your word is your bond, you know, those kind of things, right? Follow your dreams. But when it came to money, it was a much different story. It was always about never having enough. There's always a scarcity of it. We can't afford this. What do you think? Money grows on trees? I'm not made of money, you know? You know, those kind of phrases that you hear growing up. And that's kind of how I was raised when it came to money. And even worse, my daddy would even complain that his job would literally kill him. Meaning that, I mean, by his 40s, he already had strokes. He had some heart attacks just from the stress of his work. So I vowed myself never to be that person, right? I vowed not to be in a place where I felt like, you know, I just had to keep working harder and harder as I got older for potentially less and less pay. So, you know, when I was going to college, I realized I wanted to be a business consultant, but to do that, I wanted real life business experience before I just went and got an MBA in college. So I ended up, I dropped out of college. I was going to take just a little 1 year break and find some business, get some experience, then go back to college. Well, the first business that came up that became kind of intriguing to me was a financial advisor. Not that I was a financial expert by any means, right? Because all I was told to do is don't spend anything and save everything, you know? And so I thought, well, I'll give this a shot because maybe I can even help give my dad his life back. Well, I did that. I stayed dropped out of college, never went back. I stayed as an entrepreneur and as a financial advisor. Well, several years in, my dad reached out to me and said, Chris, when are you going to become my financial advisor? So I sat down with him at his table, you know, same table. He was giving me financial advice about don't spend money, save everything, right? And as we were doing that, I looked at his finances and he had been saving in his 401ks. He had paid off all of his debt, including his house. He was completely debt-free. He was basically the poster child for what we would teach as financial advisors. Well, as I'm looking at his finances, I said, okay, Dad, you're 61 years old today. If you want to retire right now, you better hope you die in 5 years because that's how long it'll be before you run out of money. Okay, Chris, that's not what I want to hear. What else can I do? I said, well, I don't know, because if I try to put you in some other stock market type of investment, who's to say that stock market doesn't go up, it might go down. You know, so I can't gamble your future away in hopes to try to make it work. I said, you got this paid off house, but you definitely can't cash out money from your house and put it in the stock market. That's actually illegal. Like you actually have to sign a document on your mutual fund saying you're not borrowing money to put in the mutual funds. Because, you know, trust me, banks and everybody else knows it's a dumb idea to try to gamble your way in the stock market. So, you know, I didn't know what to tell him. I was lost. And it was frustrating because remember, he was kind of the one that inspired me to become a financial advisor in the first place. But look, when I looked at the situation, he was doing everything right. Everything right that I had taught, he was doing, and yet it wasn't enough. And it was just a few weeks later that a friend of mine, as we were speaking, I trained him to be a financial advisor, but then he left to go do real estate investing. And we were getting this argument about what's better, stocks or real estate, right? And he finally stopped me. He said, Chris, how many of your clients are truly financially free where they don't worry about money? And he got me with that last part because the truth is, even people in retirement, even if they're retired, quote unquote, they still worry about running out of money. They think they might outlive it. So they don't want to spend too much. So they live a very meager lifestyle, very lean lifestyle. And I said, well, none of them are financially free that way. Okay, Chris, well, how about this? How many of you guys as financial advisors are financially free, not off the commissions you're earning, but actually doing these investments? Because if anybody has it figured out, it should be you guys. And as I thought about it, there were guys in my office that have been working there for 30 plus years, and they still couldn't retire either. I said, well, I don't know, maybe none. There's your problem, Chris. And that opened up a whole conversation and got me really taking that red pill, as they talk about in the Matrix, right? Where right. I went down a different path. I started to look at alternative investments, things like real estate investing instead, because I saw that if you look at the evidence, the people, the clients of financial advisors, they really aren't free, but neither are the financial advisors. So this was a problem, right? And so I wanted to find people that were free, and I found people that were in real estate investing. Some of them were in their 20s and 30s and financially free. And so I started going down that path, and pretty soon my two worlds were fighting with each other, right? Do I stay as a financial advisor knowing what I know now, where I know that, you know, it's not working, or do I leave and keep my integrity intact? And so I chose the latter. I left, stayed on as a mortgage broker instead. But then I started to learn these things. And pretty soon later that year, I was able to become financially independent myself, where I had enough money coming in passively from my investments that I was able to be work optional. I could choose to work or not go to work because I had enough money to pay my bills. And that blew my mind. I thought it would take me so many years to get to the point where I could finally live off the interest, or less than the interest, really. You know, that they talk about the 3%. You know, some people talk about the 4% rule, you know, when it comes to your retirement accounts. That rule was debunked so many years ago. I'm so shocked how many people still teach you can live on 4%. You can't do that with mutual funds. Not unless you die quickly. You can only really live on maybe 3%. If you're trying to retire young, like I was, 2%. So even if you happen to save up $1 million in your retirement account, you live on 2%, 3%, so 20 or 30,000 a year. That's not living. So
yeah,
so that's the shock. I thought I had to save up $2 million to live on 60,000 a year, because I thought 60,000, 5,000 a month was amazing 20 years ago, not today. And that's the difference, right? And where instead I was able to have enough money that I could retire right then. And that was the shocker.
Wow. Okay. Now I understand why you're called the financial advisor, because, like, you know, as much as we want to get the financial advisors to actually help us plan out our finances, but then again, these financial advisors, they are not financially free in a sense. That's right. They're still working, technically working for a financial advisory firm or a private firm, to help people to gather their accounts, check out what is it that they need to buy in terms of the plans, and then which one can give them the highest commission and all this other stuff. So they're literally like as if MLM, but they're selling this kind of products in a sense, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it really is a commission structure for them. And some of them are fee-based, but even then, I mean, a lot of those guys, although that's better in some ways, still being fee-based, they can only, when you get a license, like a securities license or an insurance license as a financial advisor, all it does is gives you a license to sell. That's it. Yeah. It doesn't make you magically smarter. All I had to do to become a financial advisor is pass a test with at least 70% and not have a criminal record. that's all I had to do. It's really not that hard. And then the hardest part is really surviving in the business. But that's where it comes down to how good of a salesman you are. Because, for example, I mean, you mentioned like being a financial advisor, you know, it doesn't mean that they're even financially free. Every year, I go to a study group with financial advisors that make millions a year, just like me, right? Now, I'm not a financial advisor, right? That's why I call myself the anti-financial advisor. I have one of my licenses still that I hold to this day. And when I go there and they hear me talk about my life, or I talk about, you know, what I teach or what I do, there's always one person every year that will pull me off to the side quietly and say, "Hey, Chris, so I want to be financially free like you. How do I do it?" Like, they don't know. And they're making millions a year. They're the guys that drive the nice cars. They drive, you know, they wear the nice suits, have the nice homes. Their life might look amazing, but they're still not free. They're still caught in their own rat race. That is the deception, because it's the blind leading the blind. Everybody thinks if you just do what they tell you to do, do what Dave Ramsey tells you to do, pay off your debt, save in those mutual funds forever, and eventually you're going to have this golden age of retirement that's going to come up. It's just not happening. Even Fidelity. Fidelity has 45 million Americans in their accounts, right? 45 million 401ks and IRAs. Of those, only 750,000 have at least $1 million in them. That's 1.5% have at least $1 million. That's still not even success, right? Because I remember, you're living on 3% of $1 million, that's 30,000 a year. Most people want more than 30,000 a year from their retirement accounts, because they know that Social Security isn't going to pick up a lot of slack. So they're going to want at least usually a couple $1 million to live on, even just live a lower middle-class lifestyle. That should be scaring you to death, because if And these are, and by the way, almost every single one of these people have over $1 million are baby boomers, Gen Xers. And by the way, of that 1.5% that actually have $1 million or more, 35% of those people said in a survey, they said it will take a miracle for them to retire. So that really means that only about 1% of people that have 401ks and IRAs say, you know what? I think I got this. You know, and now there are some people that think they got it because, like I said, there's some people that believe in the whole FIRE method, 4% rule. And that I know, especially among the millennials and Zoomers right now, they're like, oh, all I have to do is just save a bunch of money, live really cheap, and I got it. Okay, it's more than that, you know, because again, if you're going to try to do it when you're young, if you want to try to be FIRE, you better live on 2%, which means you need double the money that you think you need. It's just there's so many lies in there right now that this is why I had to come back out, because I could have just been happy being retired and doing my thing. But when everybody started asking me, well, how'd you do it? Right. And then, and especially when I realized that there were still financial advisors teaching this stuff and it's literally hurting people, I knew I couldn't keep my mouth shut any longer. And that's why, you know, I'm out there today. You know, that's why I'm teaching what I'm teaching. That's even though I don't have to, that's why I have my Money Ripples podcast. That's why I'm out here trying to bang that drum, telling people you can be free, but it's not with them.
Yeah, true. I agree. It's not with the banks, not with the financial advisory firms and all, but it's things that we're going to talk about more later on as well. And Chris, you know, I'd like to actually ask you, right, before we dive into the main focus of our interview, I want to get to know you more. And that is, like, what is the backstory of you becoming an entrepreneur, especially a financial advisor? Because I understand that you drop out of college, and then after that you don't want to go through college, and you wanted to earn more money, in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why you became an entrepreneur.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted really more control of my time and my money and my freedom, because I saw what happened to my dad. My dad had the mentality that you work for a company and you work for them for like 30, 40 years, and then they'll give you a nice retirement and then you're happy. That's kind of what his generation was taught. Well, that didn't end up being true. He would get laid off from jobs when he had good positions and he'd have to go find a new job. He'd be in the same industry, but he'd find himself either getting laid off, or if he's with that same company, you'd see like his territory is getting cut down and they would cut back on how much they paid him and things like that. So he was working harder and harder while really just trying to maintain a lifestyle. And that was something I didn't want. That's why when I became an entrepreneur, I wanted that control. I wanted to be able to really take a chance on me, right? I wanted to be able to really know that I could control the variables to some degree. I could decide what to do with my time and when I go to work and when I don't go to work. I can wake up at the crack of noon if I choose to or not, right? I wanted to have that freedom, and I didn't want somebody to tell me how much money I can make. I want to be able to have as much freedom as I wanted to do what I want. That doesn't always work for business owners. I'll tell you that. As entrepreneurs, many of them get stuck creating a job for themselves, and they end up really having just a very, very demanding, sometimes high paying, sometimes low paying job. And so you have to be careful as an entrepreneur when you do that.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And you know, being an entrepreneur is never going to be rainbows and sunshines. Sometimes you have more rainstorms than the sun that's shining on you so brightly. And you know, speaking of that, do you have a favorite failure of yours? I mean, going through your whole entire journey as an entrepreneur, I'm pretty sure you have hit some milestones and also at the same time hit some obstacles along the way, right? So do you have any of that? And also, how has that failure or parent failure set you up for later success?
Yeah, I would say one of my biggest failures, and I've had several ups and downs, but one of the biggest ones that was a shocker is, so it was 2006 when I became financially independent, right? I was able to retire when I was 28 years old. Well, as I came out of retirement in 2007 to teach people to do, you know, how to do what we did, that was right before the recession was about to hit. So myself and some partners got together, formed a company. We started teaching specifically real estate investors that are flippers. They're flipping properties, right? And and the banks first hit those of us that are trying to do flipping and things like that in 2007. The summer of 2007 is when the banking industry started to quietly shift. I saw it firsthand because I had believed, so I made my own mistake. I did two things wrong in 2007. One is that I thought that I could just put all of my extra money and my cash into my house. So I bought a newer home at that point, and I started throwing equity into that house because I was a mortgage broker. If I ever needed the cash, I could just pull it right back out, because in those days, you could pretty much just have a pulse and be able to do a cash out refinance, right? You didn't have to have a great credit score, and you could still get a cash out refinance. And so I thought, all right, I'll just do that. I'll just put all this extra money in my house. Kind of like what Dave Ramsey teaches, right? Pay down your debt, pay down your house. Well, I was doing that. So I still had savings, but I wasn't as liquid. So I had savings, but it wasn't like I had a year's worth of savings. I had probably, you know, 4, 5, 6 months of savings there. Plus I was paying extra into my house. On top of that, when I started that new company, one of the partners said, listen, like, I know you're getting all these different, you know, income streams coming in. I need you to focus. So can you cut off some of those passive income streams? Which is dumb looking in hindsight. I don't know why I agreed to it, because we were teaching people how to create passive income streams. And what was I doing? You know, so I could be focused, quote unquote, and a team player, I cut off those income streams. So I got rid of the very thing that got me financially independent. My mm-hmm. savings was good, but not great. And then I had all my equity trapped in my house. So I had assets, but I was asset rich and cash. I was becoming cash poor. Then the recession hit. You know, when I tried to go get my mortgage loan in the summer of 2007, they wouldn't let me get it. I remember asking them, they said, oh, you know what? We're just changing some rules. Just get your score up 2 more points and we'll give it to you next month. So I did. In August, I go back in and they said, oh, we just changed the rules last week. If you would just go do X, Y, and Z, then we'll give it to you in September. I go in September. I did everything they asked and they said, you know what? We stopped doing cash out refinances now. We're not giving out any more loans. Kind of similar to what we're watching happen today. We're starting to already hear about banks tightening their grip, not wanting to give money out. It's very similar. This is why I'm telling people, like, they have home equity lines of credit, don't pay them down. You know, I mean, now you might have to pay it down or try to refinance, but don't try to aggressively put all your money into cash where you may not be able to get it back out of that home equity. So that's kind of what happened to me. And so that started happening. Our business that time, because it was happening to all those real estate investors, our business was tanking. And so what was happening is that when I started, next thing I know, summer of 2007, I'm looking at my expenses. I realized, wait a minute, I'm now in the hole $15,000 a month compared to what I'm making versus what I'm spending between personal and business expenses, because everything was drying up all at once. And that was scary, because I was going from millionaire and eventually went to upside down millionaire, meaning I was over $1 million in debt eventually, because that negative cash flow wipes out everything. Not to mention the prices of the houses and stuff that I own started tanking, because I was banking that it would appreciate. I wasn't caring about the cash flow as much anymore. Ironically, I was just trying to see if I can make a lot of money off these houses, that, you know, trying to make quick money instead of trying to make consistent cash flow, passive income. So that was a big mistake that I made. It was a very difficult time. Not to mention, I felt like a fraud, because I'm the guy that's supposed to be telling everybody, here's how I did it. And guess what? I'm back in the rat race. I'm not out of the rat race anymore. I'm back in. So I actually stopped teaching people. And by end of 2007, going to 2008, I stopped teaching people about getting out of the rat race, because I couldn't just do it and feel an integrity anymore. So instead, I started teaching people what I was doing, which was getting resourceful, how to find money when you don't have money. And it's interesting, because as I started to learn from my own situation, and I was going broke. I mean, it was hard, to the point where I remember my wife at that time, that she was saying, you know what, maybe I need to take the kids with me and move in with my sister until you can figure out what's going on. So my wife's threatening to take the kids and move away, because she's like, I don't know how we're going to keep this house. And eventually we did lose the house in 2009. We did end up having to foreclose on it. Even though we tried to sell it, Lehman Brothers, who went bankrupt, as you know, didn't let us sell it. So they finally just foreclosed on us, and it sold for way less than the offers that we had for people to buy our house. So we had all these things happening all at once. You know, even, you know, my Mercedes, I turned in my Mercedes. I turned into the dealership, said, listen, you're going to take it anyways. I had creditors calling me all hours of the day. I mean, they were calling me so often that I eventually had to reframe it, you know, for me to kind of get a more positive mindset. I started calling them I love you calls, because my friends stopped calling me because I didn't have money anymore, right? So I didn't have that many friends anymore. And but those creditors, they called me every single day faithfully. So instead of ignoring their calls, I started taking their calls. I started saying, you know what? Hey, how's it going? Fine. We're here to call to collect on a debt. Yeah, I know. Okay. Will you pay that debt? Not today. All right. When are you going to pay it? No clue. All right. Well, you know, we're going to keep calling back, right? Yeah, I hope so. Okay. Thanks. Click. And that's really how those collector calls just start to go. That's when things started turn around for me in 2009. Ironically, after I pretty much sold off everything I had, had collections galore. Like I said, I was in total, it was over $1 million in debt, but I was starting to sell things back and trying to pay it off slowly. Eventually, what happened is, as I started to shift my attitude in that period of time, eventually word got out about how I was helping people find cash. Because the average person, especially business owners, they were finding like $30,000 plus $30,000 a year or more in the first year alone, not to mention grows every year after year. And so just by helping people like find ways to save on taxes or, you know, figure out ways to pay off debt creatively or things to do to just start tracking money and things to help, you know, get more, you know, just tighter on your finances, people were finding money and they were able to say, great, now what do I do with it? And I was like, well, I'm still not out of the rat race. I can't tell you what to do with it, but at least let's create more cash flow for you in the sense of having more money freed up to give you more freedom. And eventually 2009, like end of 2009, going to 2010, our company, which was almost in bankruptcy, was starting to pull out of it, and it pulled out quickly, especially in the dental and the chiropractic markets. We ended up exploding in those two markets and helping literally hundreds of people save tens of thousands of dollars a year. And that's kind of helped pull me out of that debt situation. Even as I went to go on my own, launch Money Ripples back in 2012, you know, I've been doing that ever since. And then of course, when I started doing passive income, I started teaching people how to create passive income. And lo and behold, end of 2016 for myself, I was able to get myself out of the rat race where I was financially independent for the second time. Now 39 years old, much wiser, did it better this time around so that the money sticks this time versus it's easy come, easy go.
Wow. Okay. Well, I can't imagine if I were to be in your shoes. It's definitely going to be very tough on me, especially when wife is bringing the kids out of the house instead of, you know, being so supportive, staying by your side while you are struggling and having that so shitty stress that you have. And yeah, I mean, like, and it's great that you actually reframe your mindset and you went on to tell yourself, okay, I'm loving the calls, and the calls came and you are positively talking to the people, to the creditors, and ensuring you have any more stress from there because you are actually being resourceful. And like what Tony Robbins always said, being resourcefulness is very important. So that's how you actually went on to get all this resources to help you pay off the debt slowly. And I'm pretty sure you were you like working some 9-to-5 jobs along the side?
And during that time? No. Yeah. It's funny because when you're talking about that, a memory just flashed back. I tried to get a job, a part-time job. I'll tell you, at that time, my wife at the time, she really wanted me to get a job. She's like, listen, like, I don't know why you're still with these guys. Why are you still with these partners? Because you could do better on your own. I said, I don't know. Like, I just spiritually, I feel like this is where I need to be. Like, I feel like this is the place. And it drove her nuts because she felt out of control. She's like, how do we do it? We're on welfare. I mean, we're getting handouts from people and even family or friends, like helping, giving us food and things like that, you know? And I remember I was trying to apply for a job. It was a paper route. So I could go deliver papers. And I thought, you know what? Maybe I can even stay in good shape. You know, maybe I can deliver papers on a paper route that even has apartment complexes. The funny thing is, they never called me back. I couldn't even get a job for a paper route.
Holy
That's
crap.
How unemployable I was as an entrepreneur, right? They would even call me back. I was like, okay, if this isn't a sign, I don't know what is. And maybe it was divine intervention, right? Maybe somehow it got lost in the shuffle or the paperwork. I don't know. But I mean, it was like, I can't even get a job. You know, so I was really having to figure it out on my own. And it was tough. It was really tough. I mean, even though, again, like it was all on me, it was, you know, because I had to feed my family somehow. The hard thing was, is that, you know, I found out that the company I was working with, they were gouging me and actually overcharging me for rent and for expenses in the office. So the owner, the main partner, he was actually coming out just fine because we were paying all of his bills for him. That needless to say, that guy was pretty pissed and almost everybody left that company except for me and like one other guy. And at that point I had a little bit more negotiating power because it was just him and I sitting across the table saying, all right, I'm going to do this. You cool with that? You know, I'm going to take the reins of this coaching program. And so he's like, okay, you do that. And that's when I introduced all my cash flow stuff. And he didn't even know what it was. That's the funny thing is that I won't say his name, but publicly he claims to own my content. You know, I gave him permission to use it, but he's like, yeah, this is the thing that we teach here at this company. I was like, I taught you that for 6 months. I was teaching your clients, you know, that we were bringing in. You had no clue what I was teaching. You know, I had to teach you what I was teaching the clients. They knew before you did. So that's the thing is like, it worked out perfectly because if it weren't for him though, he brought in those new relationships. He brought in some of these people that, cause I was working with my own clients, but then he said, hey, here's a chiropractic coach, a guy that coaches a lot of chiropractors. Hey, see if you can help him out. And I remember that first time we were helping him out, we found some different things to do to free up cash. But the big one was taxes. We had him do an accountant review with our accountant and found out he was overpaying $50,000 a year. That's 50, $50,000 a year in taxes. The man literally cried. He was bawling on the phone when he found out. I couldn't tell out of happiness or if it was just merely because he had overpaid for that long, you know, because we were going back to the previous three years tax returns to get that money back. So he was thrilled. Wow. And so, of course, when he found that money, he starts chatting away to everybody else. And then some of the other chiropractic coaches started hearing about this too. And this, like, what's going on? And that's kind of what got our company to explode so quickly in literally just a couple months. It went from like dead all of a sudden to just people starting to flood in. And that's the thing is like, it was the timing. It was such a hard time to go through. It was a very difficult 2 years, but it was perfect. Like it happened exactly the way it should have.
Yeah, totally. I mean, everyone has to go through shit. All this bad moments before you actually come back up again like a phoenix, right? So that's why, you know, it's not easy. When I heard that story, I was like, oh shit, it's so painful. Wow, but I'm glad that, you know, you went through it and you got over it. And after that, you ace it. And now look at where you are right now. And I'm pretty sure that there were times where you actually started to read books, right? And at that point of time, I'm pretty sure you needed some motivation, inspiration, and whatever. And you started reading books and all. So can you tell us like what are one to three books that have greatly influenced your life?
Yeah, I'll go along with this story. The ones that really kind of helped me shift my attitude, which then allowed us to shift the results of getting out of that hole. There were two books I was reading at that time. One was called 3 Feet from Gold by Greg Reed and Sharon Lecter. Sharon Lecter, you might recognize her name. She's the co-author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Yeah.
So that book, 3 Feet from Gold, is like the Think and Grow Rich for the 21st century. So they use real life stories, but they put it into a story format, but they're real people. People like True and Kathy from Chick-fil-A, the owner of Chick-fil-A, you know, and I remember reading stories in there where some of those people would say, you know, it only took me 10 years to become an overnight success. You know, little quotes like that. I was like, oh, that's deep, you know? And I'm not saying it has to be 10 years, but you know, you do hear that quite commonly with some of the success stories. So that really inspired me because it was, you know, when you're at that point of wanting to give up, that's usually when there's a breakthrough that happens. When you're about to break down, that's when there's a breakthrough. The second book that also helped was called Never Give Up by Donald Trump. This is obviously before he became, you know, more, you know, this is actually just right after he started doing like The Apprentice, right? I would say that Never Give Up was one of his more quote unquote humble books. And that says a lot for Trump, right? I mean, so he talks a lot about his failures, which is really interesting to see, you know, all the setbacks or the challenges that he would have, you know, he would talk about that. And I remember one of the things that I picked up from that book was he would say, even if there's 20 negative things, focus on the one positive. And that's what I actually started doing. I was like, man, today is a crappy day. Those collectors are, my I love you calls are still coming in a lot. Business is tight or whatever it might be, right? But I was like, okay, what am I grateful for? I'm breathing. I'm alive. My heart's still beating. I guess that's about it. And that's what I would do. I would try to focus on that positive. And it did shift some things energetically in their office that I think really allowed us to be in the right place to make a comeback. Third book I'll give you is actually one there's so many books that are good, but it just talking about money. And if you're an entrepreneur, especially, this is kind of like a must read as an entrepreneur when it comes to money. And it's called Profit First by Mike Michalowicz.
Profit First.
And that one, that one's good because many entrepreneurs, what they do is they always quote unquote reinvest their money back in their companies, right? Especially early on, you're going to be pumping a lot of your money back in. But the problem is that many entrepreneurs create a habit of doing that for their entire lives. And so they end up becoming their lowest paid employees in their company. That's not cool. Especially if you're a CEO, you should not be doing that. You know, you should be having profit come first. And so that's the main focus of the book, is how to focus on the numbers of, not instead of focusing on, well, what am I spending in this company to invest in this company? And then whatever's left over, I take as profit. Instead, decide, what do you want to take home? What do you want your profit to be? And then reverse engineer how much money you actually have to spend and invest into your company. So mindset shifts and strategies like that really was even though it was kind of common sense, it was a big shift for me. And I think for any entrepreneur, it's the problem that many entrepreneurs have, which is they just habitually always keep pumping money into the company. And although your business should be your number one investment, you should not put every egg into that basket. You really should make sure you're taking some money home, not just to have a lifestyle, but also start building additional passive streams of income outside of your business.
Okay, which we were gonna talk about it later on. I'm gonna ask you a lot on that as well, on the passive income that we can actually create for ourselves. And I'd like to ask you, right, I'm pretty sure while you're building your business up, you must have met some mentors along the way. Do you mind if you share with us who are they, and also what was the best piece of advice you've ever received from them?
Oh boy. I mean, the hard thing is that the mentors, quote unquote, I had along the way, although I did hire different coaches from time to time, and I always picked up something from everybody. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time reading books or listening to audiobooks, and then listening to podcasts like this. And I think one of the best things you can do, especially if you can't afford to hire a coach, for example, one of the best things you can do is do like what I just talked about, which is reading these books or listening to these podcasts and getting those people's, really getting their words into your head. And that's what I was really trying to do to dig out of that hole, is I don't read books. Like if somebody reads Rich Dad, Poor Dad, they try to find like, what's that strategy? What kind of investment should I be doing? That's not what you should be asking when you read a book or when you're listening to a podcast like this. The real thing you should be asking is, how do they think? Because if you know how they think, you'll be able to do the strategies, whether they talk about it or not. You'll figure it out. That's the key thing that I've learned, is that how a person thinks is so much more important than just learning what they did. Because you can learn what somebody did, and I guarantee you won't replicate it right, because one, you're not them, but two, you don't know what they know. You don't understand or have the perspective to be able to make it work the way they did. That's the key. And so for me, I mean, any books, I mean, even like, you know, business books like Seth Godin. I love Seth Godin's books, right? Like he's got so many good stuff. I mentioned Mike Michalowicz. I actually love a lot of Mike Michalowicz books. One book that really changed my life was The Pumpkin Plan. Which was one I read after Profit First, even though it was written before technically. But The Pumpkin Plan talks about, if you've ever seen in the news, those humongous prize-winning pumpkins, right? The ones that just make big news. Many people don't know that to get those prize winning pumpkins, you got to buy seeds from a farm, like a particular farms in Nova Scotia, because these are a specific breed of pumpkin. So you buy these seeds. Sometimes you'll pay up to $100,000 to buy these seeds, hoping they'll produce these prize winning pumpkins. And then as they start to grow on the vine, and if you've ever seen a pumpkin vine, they grow multiple pumpkins on a vine. You start chopping off the smallest pumpkins. Now, that might seem mean, but the reason you're chopping the smallest ones off is because you want that vine to take all those nutrients and feed one big pumpkin. And that's how it grows bigger. That vine is pumping all the nutrients in that one big pumpkin. And in my business, and this is what I learned, and when I was, my business went through kind of its own revolution, because I went through a divorce in 2015. With that same wife that was, you know, obviously that it was hard times. And even though we came out of it, still it put stress on a marriage. And so 2015, you know, I'm going through a divorce. I'm debating about quitting my business altogether. And I wasn't happy with my business. I wasn't happy with how I was doing it. I wasn't happy with the clients coming in. And I remember reading Pumpkin Plan and I thought, well, this is basically the Pareto's principle. You know, the, where they talk about the 80-20 principle, where 80% of your revenue comes from 20% of your clients. Yep. Well, I said, well, if I'm going to do this pumpkin plan thing, what if I took the 80%, what's the top 80% of that 20%, right? Or what I'm saying is, what's the top 20% of the top 20%, right? Where's the, you know, or in other words, who's the top 4% of clients that give me 96% of my results or my revenue? And I realized there was like these ideal clients that I had. Funny enough, the ones that I imaged in my mind at that time are still clients to this day, still working with us and escaping the rat race and doing an amazing job too. But that's the thing, is that I was envisioning those clients rather than the ones that I didn't like, because I had clients that I took on just because, oh, well, it's a new company, I need the money. It wasn't worth it anymore. And as I started to cut out all the extra activities of the money I was spending, pretty soon, I'm cutting out like all this networking stuff and I'm not speaking on live stages as much. I actually started focusing on my podcast and I started focusing on going on other people's podcasts, because that's where my best results were coming from, or even just audio podcasts, not just video as well. And as a result, I said, let's just cut all those things off. So I saved money, just like they teach in Profit First, right? I was cutting down and making my profits increase. So I doubled my revenue that year, even though I worked, instead of 50 hours a week, I worked 10 hours a week. So I cut my time in a fifth, my revenue doubled, but my profit quintupled. I 5X'd it in just 1 year, all because I did that. So going back to your thing about who do you listen to and stuff, like that all came from books and podcasts and just taking one thing and focusing on that. Now, I will say this, if you're an entrepreneur and you're even a coach as well, like I am, a guy you should look up is a guy named Tom Kroll. Like Kroll is spelled K-R-O-L. He doesn't even really advertise himself, but that guy, I'm telling you, I just met him really in the last year. If I had learned what he had taught, if I would have met him 11 years ago when I started Money Ripples, my company would be in a very different place today had I listened to him. And so he gives lots of great entrepreneur advice, but he's like the coach, especially if you're going to be a coach yourself, amazing guy. But even in the entrepreneur space, he's a great coach to follow too. So I would say look up Tom Kroll for sure, who's Rhino, Coaching Inc. is his company.
Okay, cool. We'll definitely go and YouTube him, Google him out. Tom Kroll, K-R-O-L. Sounds like later on I'm gonna do that as well. I'm gonna do some research on him. And wow, amazing. Well, Chris, thanks for sharing a lot, especially when it comes to books and audiobooks. Those are the things that you can afford if you can't afford a physical coach. And I truly believe that books, audiobooks, and ebooks and whatever are now feed onto your mind, and especially when it comes to the business side of things or anything that you are interested in, because if no one were to produce such amazing books through their words, through their vision and all, then people will not be able to get hold of the knowledge that is being passed down from generation to generation and from all these amazing authors and amazing entrepreneurs from from last decade and even to this decade. And I agree that, you know, being an entrepreneur, you need to read, you need to learn, you need to continuously learning rather than just depending on just one coach and that's it. And because you had a multiple mentors as well. So I reckon all those that are tuning in through the podcast, go and get your own books and your own coaches and mentors and see how they can serve you throughout your journey of entrepreneurship. And Chris, now to the main focus of our interview. I would like to ask you, right? A lot of times, many people want this thing, financial freedom. And also at the same time, they were taught that in order to get this is through passive income, right? So why does everyone need passive income?
Well, you know, 2020 made it pretty obvious for us, didn't they? I mean, when you had the government stepping in and saying, even if you're a business owner saying, you know what, you're not essential, quote unquote, so you need to shut down. And I saw even people that made millions in their business panic because, again, they didn't really focus a lot on profit. They didn't take a lot home. And of course, they didn't have any other streams of income other than their business. That was their only income. There was no different than somebody who is employed in a job that might get laid off. That's very important why you need multiple streams of income. You never, ever, as a business owner, want to be in a place where you're living out of desperation and you need business. Or even worse, if you're told you could shut down your business and then you're just as broke as everybody else. And I know I have lots of friends that make millions and millions of dollars. And some of them, if you were to shut their business down today, would be just as desperate as every other American who's got laid off. You've got to be careful that you need multiple streams of income for that very reason. And that's why I teach people, you know, kind of get into the how-to, right? You know, when you have that profit in your business, take it home, but don't spend it all. Don't just spend it all on your lifestyle, right? And I'm not saying you don't, I'm not saying live on rice and beans because that's dumb advice, right? But really bring that money home, save it, keep it liquid. Don't throw it away into 401ks and IRAs and lock it away from you. Don't put your money in prison, right? That's the worst thing you could do. You don't ever want to lose that control. You want to instead have that money, even if it's just in simple savings. And I teach another strategy called infinite banking where you can do that too. But keep that money and then use that money to invest to create more passive income. So like I mentioned, that couple, the one I envisioned in my mind even back in 2015, they have a great business that generates a lot of residual income for them. They make, you know, almost, you know, somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million a year just bringing home. Well, you know, I kind of kept planting that seed saying, listen, what if your business were to shut down? You know, what if something were to happen? And they're starting to see change in the industry today. And they're like, no, you're right. We got to get passive income streams coming in now. Like, it doesn't matter if we get residual income from our business, we need other streams of income outside of it in case something goes wrong in the industry. Well, that's what they started doing. They started getting invested in like oil and gas. Like, you know, there's oil and gas investments that we've gotten into where, you know, it's not like the typical drilling. I hope it works out. The oil's already there. The companies are already there. They just lease the land from you. You buy the land. They pay you rent to be on your land. The oil companies do. And then they also give you cuts in the royalties, things like that. Even rental properties. So, you know, we bought rental properties and things of that nature. Even partnerships. You know, I have a partnership where the partners buy and sell raw land. You know, my other clients are doing the same thing now too. There's like, hey, I want this in 3 years to turn it to 25,000 a month. For me, a year and a half, I put in 150,000 up front. And after a year and a half, it's now 7,500 a month. You know, like those kind of things are coming in. Even if my business were to shut down, I've got enough passive income coming in that I don't have to keep working. You know, I work by choice. I work because I want to, not because I have to. And I'll tell you, I've had a lot of business owners say, you know what, Chris, I love my business. But the truth is, I just want the freedom to go to work, whether I want to or not, you know, to go really money worry free, that I don't have to get that one client or that one customer. I can just go in and serve people. And that's pretty much how I live my life now. And that's what we teach people to do is how can you step up and serve people from that place of power versus from a place of necessity? You know, when you try to do business out of necessity, it's no different than having a job. But when you have enough passive income coming in that now you're going in by choice, not only do you come in with like less stress and worry, but I'll tell you, here's a secret in business. If you want to make more money in business, get yourself to a place where you don't need money.
Yes.
The more financially free I became myself, the more people wanted to actually do business with me. And this is not just me, this is other people too, right? But when you're no longer desperate and you really think clearly and you're just focused on the person and whether you can serve them or not, and definitely if there's somebody you shouldn't be serving, you can say, you know what, go away. You're not worth it. You're not worth the pain and hassle, right? Versus those that's like, you know what,
right.
I would love to work with you and I can serve you. Let's see how we can help each other. And I'm telling you, more people will say yes to you in business when you don't need money than when you do.
True. Then Chris, what needs to change if we want to have financial freedom?
The thing you have to change is, I'll say these three pieces of advice, is get lean, get liquid, and get out, right? So get lean, like I said, like make sure you have profit. Make sure you're not just blowing all your money in your business that's not coming back as a return to you. You know, make sure that there's, you know, that you're staying lean in your business, you're profitable there, you're lean at home. Don't have to cut out all fun and enjoyment out of your life. I don't mean be cheap. I mean, just be a wise steward of the money you have. You know, track your money every week. That's one thing I would definitely say is a great tool I use. In business, I use QuickBooks, right? I use QuickBooks to track my business and I'll track it weekly to see what my money's doing. But in my personal life, I use the same company, but it's just a different version called Mint, as in M-I-N-T. I use Mint instead to track my money on the personal side. And it's a free app and I can use that to track my money and it even does some of the hard work for me and the tracking. So it makes it really easy to see where I am. And I tell people do that at least twice a month. So that's how you get lean. Make sure you're tracking your money, wise steward of your money. Get liquid is what I mentioned earlier. Get your money out of prison. Don't lock it up in equity in your house. Don't throw it into 401ks and IRAs. Get that money in your possession. Don't gamble in the stock market. If you're a business owner and you're investing in other people's companies rather than your own, that's lame. You know, why invest in a company you have no control in? You're going to invest in your own business, right? So get that money liquid and then get out means once you have that money liquid, and especially when that money gets to be over $100,000, I would say, when you start to build up that cash savings, not only do you get some good reserves, then you can use it to invest to start generating additional multiple streams of passive income. And when I say passive, I mean passive, not passive in the marketing sense where people say, hey, you can buy this online store, you know, Amazon store, which is anything but passive, or hey, you can go do passive real estate investing. But what they're really telling you is you can create this whole brand new real estate business that's part-time or full-time hours. And then you get, quote, you know, technically from an accountant's perspective, passive income. I mean, passive meaning you can use your money, turn it over. I can lend money to investors like real estate investors and get paid 10-12%+ returns, you know, things like that. That's what I mean by passive, is that your money does the hard work for you, not the other way around.
Okay, understand. Okay, cool. And I would like to ask you, right, I actually saw this in your website the other time, and I noticed that there's this three things that you mentioned on the mindset, and that spender, steward, and saver. So can you tell us what are the key differences between these three mindsets?
Yeah, so two of those mindsets, spender and savers, are in scarcity. Just so you're aware, scarcity, when you live a life of lack, a life of limits, a life of never enough, when you live in scarcity, it's never enough. And in fact, that you will never be financially free in scarcity. Now, spenders, they always get the bad reputation, right? Because they're the ones that are told, you know, oh, these guys, they suck. You know, they just blow money. And it's true. It's easy come, easy go. And they're great at knowing how to make money, but they ignore how much money they're spending. And that's why they're always in a rat race. But the other scarcity one that also doesn't lead to freedom is the one that everybody tells you to do, which is being a saver. Everybody's saying, be a saver, you know, be the person that pays off your debt, saves everything. You know, I have a lot of clients, especially on the West Coast, especially if they're, you know, if they're of Asian descent, they're very much taught and trained. You save everything, you pay off your debt, right? And and they're very, very strict about it. They do a great job, but they never become truly free because they get to the point, just like what a lot of the people that become our clients, they get to a point saying, wait a minute, now I'm debt free. I have a couple million dollars saved up, but it's not really generating any real income for me. So what they realize later on is that the thing they wanted the whole time was income. That's what they wanted. They wanted passive income coming in because they threw their money into the stock market. They realized, oh, I can't pull off that much money because I could run out of money if there's market swings, ups and downs, and things like that. Especially if the market goes down and you pull cash out at the same time, you may never recover. You may never get that money back ever. So for that reason, that's why, you know, the saver never becomes free, because it's never enough. They can never save enough. They can never pay off their debt fast enough. It's just never enough. The steward takes the best of the spender and the saver and puts it into one. Because the one thing that a spender does well is they're willing to use money. Money is meant to be used, and it's meant to be used wisely to grow it, multiply it, to really amplify what you have, right? And I believe that's true, not just with money, but with everything in life, is how do we make it better? How do we improve our lives? How do we improve ourselves as a steward too, right? How do we improve our talents? You know, how do we do all that? Same thing with money. How do we improve upon it? See, spenders, they'll blow it, but it never comes back. So if they could be wise with it, more like the saver. The saver's willing to be wise, but they just sit on it. They park it, and they don't do anything with it. They set it and forget it, as you hear them say, right? Mm-hmm. Well, if you can have somebody who can be wise with the money, be wise with it, and willing to use it, put that together, you get a steward. And that's where the investor perspective comes from. That can come from a place of abundance. There's actually freedom possible in that perspective. So those are the three key paradigms that you have to have around money.
Oh, okay. Interesting. And, you know, speaking of saving, do you have any percentages that you would recommend for us, for the audience, to actually start, starting off with saving their own money? What's the percentage that you would actually ask these people to save? And then after that, what's the percentage that they can actually use for investments as well?
Yeah. So if you're trying to invest money in the stock market, like I mentioned earlier, plan to save 80 to 100% if you want to have a similar lifestyle down the road. I've shown people by the numbers, if you put money in a 401k, even with a match, whatever you pay into that 401k per year is the lifestyle you'll have after inflation when you try to pull it back out. Because the returns in the stock market are very, very low compared to what they tell you. As a financial advisor, I always told you it was 10 or 12%, right? That's what I would say. Financial advisors still say that today. And they might even say, if I'm being conservative, I'll say 8% conservatively. Well, the truth is right now, the market's averaged about 7.7% for the last 30 years. Most mutual funds don't even get 7.7%. Give you an example. Fidelity, right? Fidelity is the number one 401k provider. They've got their target date retirement funds. Now, these are the funds that say, if you want to retire in 2040, here you go, just put your money in this fund. And they invest it for you as if you're going to retire then. 2055, 2060, right? Well, here's the issue. I just ran the last 10 years numbers on those funds. The stock market for those last 10 years, 2013 to 2023, averaged 10.1% in the S&P 500. But those funds averaged 8% flat. So they did 2% worse than the stock market. And remember, the stock market long-term averaged closer to between 7 to 8%. So that means you're between 5 and 6%. But wait, there's more, because those 401k funds have a 0.75%, a 0.75% charge every year on your money. So that means you're losing almost 3% compared to the stock market. So if the stock market did, say, 7.7%, that means you're making less than 5% a year in those funds. That's about that's conservatively what I believe inflation is actually doing in reality. Don't believe the government numbers of the 3% average or whatever they say it is. That's not true. They manipulate those numbers all the time, so they have to pay more in Social Security, right? Well, if even inflation is 5%, which I think is a low number, that means whatever you're saving is exactly what you can pull out later. You're like, your stock market is just barely keeping up. In fact, it's probably more likely losing to inflation every year, just like if you were to put money in a savings account. Although, yes, the stock market is still better overall, it's just not performing well, especially in 401ks. So when you say, like, where do we put this money? Well, like I said, first and foremost, we can keep it in a savings account for now. Keep it liquid. Don't put it there. But that's where I recommend going instead into alternative investments, going to places like doing real estate, where I can make double-digit returns very easily. Last 5 years, just so you know, the stock market did 52% in 5 years. But I had a property I bought in Memphis 5 years ago that has done over 300%. If you include the cash flow, you include the fact that the renters paid down my mortgage, so I built equity automatically. And of course, there's appreciation. By the way, of that 300%, about 200% is appreciation. The other 100% was just cash flow. I still beat the stock market, even if I had no appreciation in my property. That's the difference. And not to mention, I get tax advantages too. So that beats the stock market there again. So that's the thing. Is that there's so many more alternatives, so many better things you could be doing. But yeah, you just don't want to have your money in the stock market. That's the one place I would not put my money.
Okay, interesting. Because we all know that the grandfather of stock market is actually Warren Buffett, right? He plays with the stocks, and not play, but he invested in, and he gained a lot of money, and he's one of the billionaires in the whole entire world. So, because your advice is to not really put too much into the stock market, but go into the alternatives, right? So I would say it's very different from what I've learned, especially when it comes to Warren Buffett. When he says that you have to do value investing rather than investing in property, or unless Warren Buffett has investment in property, investment in stocks and many other things, which he doesn't tell. It's just that many people know that he's the forefathers of investments, so that's why he is well known for his stock investments.
Well, that's the funny thing is that he's actually not a stock investor. If you really study Buffett, you actually realize that one, he does buy real estate. In fact, he even had a regret 10 years ago. He wished that he could buy more real estate. He said, "I wish I could buy single family homes." So instead, he would buy companies that would invest in single family homes, right? Notice what Buffett does. One thing, first, we're not Buffett, right? We don't have that much cash. But secondly, Buffett doesn't buy stocks. Buffett buys businesses. Whenever he buys into a company, he buys a controlling interest of that company. He makes sure that he's on the board. So like when he bailed out like Bank of America, for example, right? When he bought a bunch of their stock, he bailed them out, so they didn't go bankrupt during the last recession. But he bought a huge share in it so that when he buys that into a share in that company, yes, he believes in it, but he also brings in his team as well to make sure that he secures his investment. So he wants to make sure that that happens. He bought a furniture franchise outlet that's actually based out here out of Utah, but they're now all over the western half of the United States. Well, he bought the share into that. He bought it for the very fact that he knows that business. He bought a furniture business in Omaha as well, right? So he knows that business. He stays in those same industries. And I remember I was reading the book from the CEO of that company when he sold it to Buffett. So they were kind of like partners. Like Buffett was the owner. He was the CEO. And I remember that owner said, I want to put one of these stores in Las Vegas. And Buffett said, "Nope, that's not going to work." And they're flying the helicopter together as they're doing it. And Buffett's like, "No, that's not going to work. Furniture stores get most of their sales on Sundays. And I know that you don't like to be open on Sundays. That's never going to work in Vegas." So the CEO said, "Well, listen, if I go and I do a store up in Boise, Idaho, which is very similar to Vegas and their demographics, if I do a store up there and I make it succeed, will you let me do a store in Vegas?" And Buffett's like, "Okay, fine." And they end up doing it. The Boise store exploded. And so then Buffett then opened up the Vegas store, and Buffett even went and said, "Hey, this is the best idea I ever had," joking, because obviously it wasn't his idea. It was the CEO's. but that's the thing. Like he makes sure he insures his investment. That's different than us as trying to buy a Tesla stock or Apple or Amazon, right? We have zero say in that company, zero say at all. He buys companies, and he buys at least enough percentage so that he has a voice and he has some influence over what happens in that company. Otherwise, he's out. He doesn't do it. That's the difference between Buffett and you and I. And in some ways, if you're an entrepreneur or business owner, it's not that much different because you have full say in your business. You can do the same thing Buffett does as well. You can even invest in other businesses if you try to buy into a smaller company, right? You could do that too. You could buy into a franchise and do the same kind of thing. So understand that Buffett, when he does this, his whole Berkshire Hathaway fund really is based in him owning companies, not just buying and selling stocks.
Okay, got it. Wow, thanks for the explanation, because I always thought that, oh, we are gonna be rich like Warren Buffett if we do this value investing kind of strategy to pick on the stocks and to see how we can actually grow our stocks during that period of time. But well, now that I understand more on this, so guys and girls, remember, don't just buy stocks, go and buy the companies instead. So okay, okay, cool. And I would like to ask you, right, earlier we were talking about having money and how we can actually not really create a new job or business, right? So how can we actually find money in such situations?
You know, the best way to find money is, like I said, tracking the money is a great way to do it, right? If you start to track and see where your money's going, it's easy to see where the money leaks are. And so when you start to track your money, really start to pay attention, like, what am I spending money on? And is it productive? Is it useful? And I'm not saying you can't have consumptive expenses, right? But especially in your business, you really want to make sure that when you put money in, you know, if you put a dollar bill into that magic ATM, you want at least $2 bills coming back out, right? Right. So like in business owners, a lot of times people put a lot of money into marketing and advertising, but it doesn't always produce a result. This is like my story in 2015 when I realized I'm reevaluating my whole business and saying, man, I'm working 50 plus hours a week. I'm going to all these different networking events and I'm going to speak on stages. Sometimes I'm even flying out of state to do it. And is that really productive? Is that giving me a good ROI, not just on my money, but on my time and energy? And which to me as an entrepreneur, energy is even more important than time, and time's more important than money, right? So I want to make sure I'm getting a good ROI on all three. And that's when I realized, I said, wait a minute, I'm looking at what I'm putting my money into, it's not working. So really, really, you got to be, as a CEO, you got to know your numbers. You got to understand what's going on in your company. Otherwise, you're going to lose money left and right. That's the best way to recapture it. I even saw this with one of my clients. Sometimes it's money leak. Sometimes the money leak is also on the income side too. I had a guy where he was actually a mortician. So he owned a funeral home. Mm-hmm. And as we were looking at it, we were looking at his numbers. I said, well, wait a minute, your pricing, you mentioned that people are coming to you because of price. Well, that means you're a commodity. What if we raised your price to at least be the average? What's the average right now? And he told me the average. It was like $2,000 more for the typical funeral expense. I was like, so you're basically leaving $2,000 on the table for every single customer you have coming through. And the problem is that you're the cheap one. And if you're the cheap one, that's not good. I'm like, by the way, do you do cheap service? No, we do great quality service. We do this as a value add and this. I'm like, great. If you're going to keep doing those value adds, you should be at least standard what everybody else charges, or even a little bit higher, because people will perceive you. If you're adding more value, people will see it being more. This happened to me when I was a mortgage broker. It's funny because as a mortgage broker, when I was a financial advisor, I thought, well, I have to cut back my fees for people who want to use me. But what I found out is eventually when I left being a financial advisor, I started charging the standard fees. The funny thing is more people said yes. More people actually said yes to me than no. And it wasn't just because I was teaching a cool strategy about how to invest with the equity of your home, but it was really because people just thought, oh, you're charging the standard amount. You must be at least good, if not great. You should at least be able to do the job. But if I'm always discounting and discrediting myself, saying, oh, well, I'll do the cheaper version, they're going to think they're going to get cheap, crappy service, right? Yeah. And so when I started charging at least the standard 1% origination fee as a mortgage broker, I made more money. Same thing happened to this guy at the funeral home. It actually made him an extra $200,000 just because he was willing to charge even at least the average. That's the thing. There's so many money leaks. It's either money leaks from money you're spending you shouldn't be, or money you're not earning because you're not charging it right.
Yeah, totally agree with you on that. We got to charge accordingly and according to the market rate, rather than charging it so low, because if we charge low, people will lowball us even more because they will not want to pay that amount. They will even like try to cut it, have discounts from you and all. So I believe it's better to pay to actually charge premium. So people will, if they want to ask you for some discounts, you can still give probably a 5% or whatsoever, and you still profit from there. And yeah, I totally agree with you on that. And as you know, Chris, as we are coming to the end of the podcast, I have one last question for you, and that is this. Chris, imagine this. You suddenly lose everything, okay? Your money, your name, your reputation. So what will you do from day one to day 30 to save yourself?
You know, almost the same thing I did when I launched Money Ripples. I had to launch Money Ripples very quickly because the partner and I that was working together in our previous company decided that we're going to call it quits very quickly. And pretty soon I was out on my own. I was like, well, I just come up with the name Money Ripples just a week before. It was very serendipitous how it happened. And so I did what I knew worked, which is the industry that I was in, right? So I focused, my market that I was focusing on was women entrepreneurs. So, and locally in the state of Utah. So I just stayed local. So I went and I found people that were those most influential people in that space, right? So the people that were the centers of influence, I went, I invited them. I said, hey, let's do brunch or lunch together. And naturally they were skeptical because they know that people have tried to use them before. I said, listen, I just want to get to know you better and just see if there's a way I can serve you. And legitimately, when I did those lunches, I would actually go and start asking them about their lives, about their businesses, what's going on. And I'd be listening to see if there was something that they would say that I could help with, right? Like it could be something in their personal life. It could be something in their business life. There's some knowledge that I have that could help them. Is there some connection I could give them that could help them too? And so even though they came in, some of them came in skeptical, thinking I was just going to take something or pitch them something. I didn't pitch myself at all. In fact, they had to pull it out of me because I'd be like, there's like, yeah, but what about you? Like, cause they could see I was trying to serve them. Like, yeah, but what about you? I was like, yeah, right. I've got my company Money Ripples, helping people with money and stuff. You know, if you put in a good word for me, that'd be great. You know, or, you know, you're welcome to check it out if you want to check it out. I'm looking to get more speaking engagements or whatever it might be, you know, looking to do this. And so I started doing that and nothing happened for a few months other than those people would talk to other people and say, hey, this Chris guy is different. You should check him out. And so they would talk me up and then somebody else would say, hey, I've heard about you from multiple people telling me about you. Who are you? And I got more opportunities. So even though it was lean months for probably a good 5 or 6 months, but because I did that so fast within those first 30 days, by month 6, things started to take off. And within a year, I was making over $100,000 a year just because of those centers of influence, you know? So that's the key thing I would recommend is that if you have no money, no reputation, brand new location, you find, you know, you figure out what market you're going to, where you're focusing, right? And who you're trying to serve. And then find those people that are already in those markets and serve them. Focus on always creating value for other people, always giving them a win-win, helping to serve them or help them, you know, solve problems for them in such a way that they remember you and they want to be able to reciprocate and serve you back at some point.
Okay. So you're saying that it's okay to work for free first before you actually get money from them in a sense.
Oh, absolutely. And especially if you're trying a brand new business, you know, if you're trying a brand new service, you got to beta test it, right? So you might charge little to nothing in the beginning, just say, hey, I want to test this out. And actually I did that for my first, I did announce on Facebook and LinkedIn. I said, hey, my first 10 clients, I'll charge just $1,000. I used to charge $25,000 for this. I'll charge you a $1,000, but in exchange, you have to give me a testimonial and referrals. And they did that, you know, so I would want the testimony and referrals. I was like, yeah, I want the beta testers in this new company. I had a non-compete, by the way. That's why I was doing that. And so if you will be able to work around that non-compete, get in a new market and then break into it quickly. Yeah, I got some beta testers, got some early raving fans, got referrals, and that just kind of built from there.
Oh, wow. Nice. Well, thank you so much for all these golden nuggets that you have dropped over here. Really appreciate you, Chris. And also at the same time, what's next for Money Ripples and for Chris Miles?
You know, right now we're just constantly building our YouTube channel, the Money Ripples channel, and we have a Money Ripples podcast channel. We're building that. And really we're just, our big focus is in by 2030, we have 1,000 people or families financially independent, you know, where they're work optional. They can work because they want to, not because they have to. So that's what we're working towards. We already got several people there and looking to get a lot more people over the next 7 years.
Wow, nice. Okay, cool. Wow, looking forward to that, to seeing more people impacted by you guys. And also at the same time, where can my audience find you on social media?
Yeah, anywhere you can find us is at Money Ripples. You can find us there. Some of those ones, I also have Chris Miles there as well. But yeah, if you look up at Money Ripples, you can find us there on social media. Like I mentioned, YouTube, the Money Ripples or Money Ripples podcast channel as well.
Okay, awesome. Well, with that, I would like to thank Chris for being here with us with all this incredible golden nuggets that you've dropped. And also at the same time, thank you for everyone who's tuning in to the podcast. Really appreciate you guys for listening to this episode, and stay tuned for the next episode of the Legacy Show. With that, take good care of yourself and good night. Okay, bye-bye. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of The Legacy Show. I hope it has enlightened you. I hope it has brought you to an epiphany where you realize that this is where you want to go and this is what you want to do. So I hope you will continue to support and also at the same time like, comment, and share this episode out to your people, to your family, your friends. And not forgetting that we have just created a Telegram group. It's called the Legacy Show Family. So you can go and check it out and let us know how you find this group is serving you. All right, so with that, I would like to thank you once again. See you and stay tuned for another episode of the Legacy Show.